Astrophysicists are smart,
really smart.
How do they get that way?
My guess is education.
We have one, and we're going to ask it.
Segregation still happening in 2018?
Paul Thomas says yes.
Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From edweek.org. A commentary by Gloria Ladson Billings. She says free speech is under attack in the government. Are schools next? The CDC's seven banned words present troubles ahead for education.
The CDC, that would be Centers for Disease Control, just for the busted. Okay, in case so we're not out there. Interesting piece by Gloria Ladson Billings, because if it's all in the news, we've got seven new dirty words.
I can't keep track of the first seven dirty words. Come on.
George Carlin in the 70s put forth the seven dirty words you can't use on television, and we can't use them here on radio either. We'll just tell you, go Google George Carlin's seven dirty words and see what they originally were.
We've got a whole new list now,
and Gloria, though, presents this as, does this give us a problem in schools? And I like the way she lays out this commentary, where she actually would use what she said as a school teacher. She would ban words when she was teaching, right?
That was really neat. I like the way she did that.
Because what she said was, every time, you know, every student would say, interesting. This is interesting. This is interesting. And so interesting would be banned for the day. And till one day, one student said, yo, Mrs. Bell, check this out. But this is against free speech.
Right.
For you to be banning words.
You can't do that. She was impressed with
it. And she was really impressed and brought this back. But then this brings her back, though, into this looking at the CDC's new banned words. And will they present problems for educators in the future? So let's take one of the new banned words.
Okay.
Diversity.
Okay. Can't say diversity.
Can't say diversity. All right.
Big line through it.
That's a tough one. What happens in classrooms when you're talking about diversity? So ethnic diversity, racial diversity. Mm-hmm. How about in science if you're talking about biodiversity?
Oh, yeah.
Things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so the creeping of saying we're going to start banning words starts to be a bit of a problem in public schools, because now you can actually limit the content. So, for example, let's keep staying on diversity. Diversity, why is diversity banned? Well, diversity is one of those words that actually makes us think about things that we might not want to talk about. And mm-hmm. so when we're talking in school specifically about we need to have a diverse student body.
Right.
Somebody automatically says, well, that just means you're socially engineering the crowd to be who you want, right? Mm-hmm. Or things like that. You were going to add to that.
No, I was going to say it's interesting because everybody has a different way when I read these list of words. When you say diversity, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, you can look at it as a good thing.
Right.
Or as a bad thing. And depending on how you've been brought up. You don't know how it's going to go.
And so Gloria points that out, saying, in fact, the possibility might be that somebody could present the case, if this is now a banned word mm-hmm. in school now, why shouldn't be saying banned words as a teacher? And that presents a real problem. How about this one, though? And I love this at the end of the piece where she talks about science-based or evidence-based, right?
Right.
Now, for the last 20 years, teachers have been under attack to, quote, stop teaching from their head and to use science and evidence-based practices. Okay? So here's a real dilemma. So what are teachers now going to do? They've been yelled at for not being science-based, and now they're going to be yelled at for using the word science-based. Mm-hmm. It's a no-win situation. All I can say here is, I'd rather go back to George Carlin's seven banned words and just stick with those. And let's leave diversity and science and transgender. Let's leave those alone.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
The Bartleby Project and Opting Out. From John Taylor Gatto's book, Weapons of Mass Instruction. Quote, I'm inviting you to join a real conspiracy. Call it an open conspiracy with real consequences on millions of real lives. I know that sounds megalomaniacal, But be patient. If we pull this off, a great many will bless us. Although the school industry, few will curse us. This is about a project to destroy the standardized testing industry. This adventure is called the Bartleby Project. End quote. My son loves the show Mythbusters. From the time he put two Legos together, he was hooked on constructing intricate things. He creates Rube Goldberg contraptions, loves animals. He can manipulate through different technologies and doesn't need instructions because his curiosity enables him to navigate and learn. He also loves football. He watches the NFL channel around the clock and can give you just about any statistic related to the game or players. This is just a snapshot, a quick glimpse of my son outside of that insidious institution we call public schooling today. I'm currently thinking hard about asking my son to participate in the Bartleby Project and to write, quote, "I prefer not to take your test," across the top of his high-stakes state test. Question, though, is it fair to ask my son to carry out an act of civil disobedience? Should I place this social burden on his shoulders? What will the consequences be? Can he handle the pressure? Should he even have to handle the pressure? Since late in August, my son has been subjected to a system of indoctrination that has essentially squashed his inner desire to learn. Months devoid of intellectually stimulating classroom experiences. He's been forced to complete worksheets in language arts and mathematics. He can alphabetize spelling words. He can find the main idea of a paragraph. He's had practice in sequencing. He can round numbers. He can add, subtract, multiply, and divide with fractions and decimals. And he has mastered the scripted art of estimating. You're right, I never knew you could actually script estimating, but you can. He has taken multiple practice tests, and according to these tests, my son is ready. He has been trained to produce high test scores. Scores that will help prove that he has been held accountable. I'm sure his school is counting on him. But what has been lost? He sits in social studies and science classes that have been shortened to allow more time for reading and math instruction. He hasn't been given the opportunity to engage real literature. Some of his teachers are clueless about his interests. Drudgery. How much can he take before just the thought of going to school immobilizes him? There's real damage being done. Something has to happen before my son loses all curiosity. As his father, I need to advocate for him. But I don't want to just go in and take him out of school. I want him to learn something. I want him to experience real opportunities to learn in school. I want him to learn about the courage needed to change social structures that are designed to ultimately guarantee mass failure. Maybe he'll be the start of a movement. This is the perfect opportunity for my son to learn about social justice. He has a chance to fully participate in the democratic life we are supposedly striving to instill in children. But why does he have to do it? Well, because as John Gatto said, quote, "Because these tests pervert education. They're disgracefully inaccurate, impose brutal stresses without reason, and actively encourage a class system which is poisoning the future of the nation." Is my son capable of sitting down at his desk and simply writing, "My name is Luke, and I refuse to take your test"? Will this be the start of something? An act of civil disobedience to inspire all students and even teachers from participating in the anxiety-producing, high-stakes system of testing ruining our public schools? Is this the opt-out moment?
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
I've had something on my mind a lot lately. Can't stop thinking about it. You know, and I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would say.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Nancy, I think this is one that's near and dear to your heart. It's not surprising, but the kindergarten readiness gap has gotten worse.
When I read this article, I just said, oh, please. And these, I think they're wonderful researchers who've written it.
Okay.
And I respect them, but we don't need more studies telling us that the readiness gap still exists.
Right.
I mean, come on. We're the We have a bigger child poverty rate in the United States than any other wealthy country. We don't have, you know, when I was just in Canada, the province I was in, they have a year family leave policy. If two people are pregnant, they get a year of family leave. They can distribute it either way between them. In Ontario, it's a year and a half. Hmm. Come on. I mean, yeah. there's so many supports. A lower child poverty rate in Canada. There's Medicare for all in Canada. So children come to school ready to thrive and to succeed because they're not hungry, they're not sick, and they're not anxious like poor kids in the United States.
Yeah, I said the same thing when I read this. It's like, do we really need another study? And the answer is no. However, I do think we need to constantly remind people, and if it has to be through an empirical study, that poverty is a real problem, then you know what? I think we might need to continue to crank them out. One of the, you know, I went a little bit deeper than just this article and went and saw some other things, and I just wanted to interject this into the conversation. Mm-hmm. But what's significant now as opposed to even 15 years ago, and this was the way they framed it, was it's harder to be poor now than it was 15 years ago.
Yeah. And why did they say that?
Because the rate of income, and we know this, right? The income levels of people have actually dropped. And so not only were you poor, but you are more poor than you were 16 years ago. And so in one way, it's a weird thing. So a middle class person, that we know their wages have actually stagnated and dropped over the last 15 years. So to imagine that you were, quote, poor 15 years ago, that now you're even more poor. And so how does being, and it sounds almost kind of, I don't know, heartbreaking or silly or both, but to have the pain of poverty be even more painful, how does that then affect children getting ready to come to kindergarten? And so hence the readiness gap that we're now looking at. Maybe it's not surprising that it's, quote, still there, but the fact is that if we dig deeper, it's more painful, the gap.
The gap is more painful, and it's also we know more, you know. For example, the neuroscience field has come out with a lot of research very recently about how poverty affects brain development. So there are long-term effects of poverty that aren't even what's being experienced in the immediate moment, which is bad enough, but has long-term implications for healthy development, for mental health, and for learning.
Mm-hmm.
And they've shown the brain scientists how the brain wiring is affected from the effects of poverty. So I find it unbelievable, given that we have so much research and have had it for so many years about the importance of the early years in the health of a society. I think it's phenomenal that we continue to treat so many large percentage of young children in ways that are, you know, are harmful and just without any reasonable healthy societal supports.
Yeah, we look at it and we make decisions that are right in front of our face that could be
right.
Easily done, such as just simple. And I go back to Stephen Crash and always talking about just a moderate level of health care, a moderate level of
yep.
nutrition, and a moderate
yep.
level of exposure to books and what we could do.
Yeah, there's also the issue that poor families now, many of them, the parents are working double jobs to get by, and the kids are alone. The kids are left alone. We know that poor kids watch many more hours of screen time, have many more hours of screen time, and fewer activities and less time outdoors than wealthier children. So, you know, the quality of life is just immeasurably worse for poor kids than for kids of means. And that, it just doesn't take half a brain to know that.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
He's the author of two books, Treknology and Beyond the Galaxy. He's also the founder and primary writer of Starts with a Bang. He is astrophysicist and author Ethan Siegel. Welcome to Busted Pencils.
my pleasure to be here. You know, anyone who's doing what they can to improve science education and education in general across the country and the world, especially when you know, we need it now more than ever. We need people to be aware of and appreciative of what science is and what it does for our society. So, you know, thank you for that great introduction, but my kudos really go to you and all your listeners out there who are fighting every day in the trenches to make this country really the country we want to live in.
I thought you were going to say make America great again, and I was, you know, wait a minute, that line's been used before, but hey. All right, first question, though, is really an exploding star and I can get DNA?
You know, so, yeah, if you take a look at the universe and what was in it right after the Big Bang, you know, the universe is hot and dense and expanding and cooling, and with all of those particles flying around, you know, you do get protons and neutrons colliding, fusing together, building their way up the periodic table. As it turns out, you can't even get to carbon. You can't get to carbon, to nitrogen, to oxygen, to all of those elements that are essential to life as we know it. All you really get out of it, 99.999999%, is hydrogen and helium. So how do you get human beings and the essential ingredients for life? You have to create them in stars. And far and away, the overwhelming majority of the elements essential to our life processes are made in the cores of massive, giant stars that end their life in a supernova. So when you say, where does my body come from? Yeah, about 9% of it by mass is that hydrogen left over from the Big Bang. Everything else was made in a star, and about 3 out of every 4 atoms in your body by mass were in fact created in a supernova explosion.
Okay, so now with that, where will I find that on a standardized test?
You know, there's a really big difference, and I think everyone who listens to you is well aware of this. There's a really big difference between learning the kind of knowledge you need to learn to do well on a standardized test and actually having a genuine, comprehensive understanding of any subject in general. There's a difference between how you're evaluated and what your education is. You can do extremely well in school on a standardized test, even in life, by just learning all the things you know right in advance of the, you know, of the testing situation, of the example where you need to know it. But if you want an understanding, if you want a deeper understanding, if you want to know what's going on, how is it happening, why is it happening the way it is, that's going to require learning something that you can't really measure or assess through a standardized test. But if you're a teacher who's interested in not how well are my students going to do in 4 months when they take that big standardized test, but what are they going to take away into the world? What is this person going to know a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, and what skills are they going to take with them through life to help them be a successful adult? Those are two very different things you can teach towards.
So, and this is how the two of us got together, an educator and an astrophysicist, because I happen to be perusing the internet or browsing or whatever you want to call it, and on Forbes.com I come across how America is breaking public education, and boom, right away, that's an instant clickbait for me because I need to see who's writing something about something I like. And here it is. It's you, Ethan Siegel, who is an astrophysicist who took a break and said, wait a minute, America is breaking public education. So I just wanted to get that in there for the listener to make the connection. But Ethan, I mean, so this is the, we're breaking public education, according to you, according to this piece, in many ways, largely, and I threw the standardized test in there, but talk to me a little bit about your interests and why this is important to you.
Well, I mean, the first thing thing that wants to come out of my mouth is, what, so astrophysicists can't be educators now? So, no, of course we can. And the thing is, for me, I've always, as a person, had an interest in education. I think it's important. I think it's good for society and good for the world. I grew up getting a public education in New York, in New York City and in Westchester County. That's where I grew up. That's where I went to school, and I got a great education there. And then after I finished college, I went and became a public high school teacher. I was teaching physics and physical science in Los Angeles. And after that, it was actually doing that I decided, you know what, here I am on the teaching side of the classroom trying to get young minds excited and aware of what's wonderful and what we can know and how we can know it in the world and in the universe. But what do I want to know? What do I want to be learning? And so that was what brought me to graduate school to study theoretical astrophysics, to become a cosmologist. And since then, I became a research scientist and then a professor. And now most of what I do full-time is I communicate science to the general adult population. But my love for teaching in general and for pedagogy and for helping people get the most out of their education is something that's never faded or gone away. When I left the teaching profession, it was right during the first term of George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. And that really aligns with approximately the time at which standardized testing began to become not only more widespread, but began to be tied to things like the funding of schools and teacher evaluations. And as soon as you start doing that, what you start doing is you start disincentivizing this kind of real learning, this kind of deep investigation, and this type of individualized education plans that have been the hallmark of great teachers and innovative classrooms throughout history. As soon as you start saying, no, everyone needs the same outcome, everyone needs to aspire to the same goals, you know, you're taking away teacher autonomy, and you're taking away their ability to excel at their subject matter, to excel at what they're teaching, and to excel at their ability to reach the particular kids in their classroom.
So, but you're kind of speaking blasphemy, though, as you're talking about teaching the way you're talking about it. With No Child Left Behind ushered in what was supposed to be the fix to American public education, the standardization, making sure that tests were there to measure students so that we know where they're at, to make sure that we can monitor teachers, that they're teaching what they're supposed to. I mean, all of it was solved by putting forward standardization, and you're saying no?
Of course I'm saying no. I mean, you say no too all the time.
I know.
You're playing devil's advocate
right
here. But this is the kind of BS propaganda, like, oh, the sun never sets on the British Empire. Like, who believes that? Nobody believes that. This is not what you get by a measurable outcome. You know, the whole reason this came up for me is last month I was away at a conference on the frontiers of fundamental physics. It was the 15th anniversary conference, and there are two tracks there. One is on fundamental physics research, where we talk about astrophysics and particle physics and mathematical physics and this cutting edge of theoretical physics. And on the other hand, at the same conference, we have a whole track on physics education research. And it was really listening to a few Europeans talk about the way that they study things and what their results are and what does and doesn't work. And there's this push towards standardization, not just in the United States, but in a myriad of countries around Europe and the world, from Morocco to Poland to all over. The countries that are eschewing that, the countries that are saying, no, we don't do that, we recognize we have individuals, we recognize that we have teachers who excel and can do something that's far beyond what the standard education is going to offer them, that's what leads to the greatest outcomes. That's what leads to the best success. That's what leads to long-term student learning. And if we just fund everybody on the promise that we can say, you know what, the most important things we can do is we can treat teachers like professionals. right? In any other job, you don't tell someone what to do and how to do it and hold their hand and have them read from a script. No, you say you are a skilled, talented human being who has invested your life in excelling in this field. Now take what you've learned and do your best at the subject that you're a master at and at this profession that you're a master at. Go ahead and show me your mastery and do your absolute best. We don't do that with teachers. As soon as you say, not only here's how to teach, we're even going so far as to telling teachers what to teach. This is absurd. This is a recipe for disaster. And just as you said, with things like No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top or whatever, I forget the name of the recent thing that's replaced it under Obama, but these are ideas that, oh, you know what, we have this problem of mediocre, unqualified teachers, and if we just standardize everything, we can lift them up. No, you can't. There's no recipe for elevating a terrible teacher to the ranks of a good teacher. But there sure is a recipe for taking the elite teachers, for taking the best teachers, and for taking those who aspire to become better teachers and just capping what they can do or even penalizing them for doing a great job.
We are talking to astrophysicist and awesome educator Ethan Siegel. Ethan, you were going through all of the things that we would do to make teachers great or look at great teachers, and I was kind of talking about saying, you know what, though? I think there's a little bit of an insidious motive behind the standardization, and let me float this to you and get your reaction. The reason why we have standardized and taken away the liberty from teachers is because we don't want really good teaching. We want average, because this mediocrity, standardization, is a recipe for the status quo and keeping things the way they are. And this benefits politicians to be able to say, look, there's nothing changing in public education. Therefore, my new solution as a politician is why you should elect me.
You know, I think that that's whenever you see the possibility of there being a nefarious motive coming from someone in power to keep themselves in power, there's probably a kernel of truth behind it. I don't know that that's the full reason. I see lots of reasons and rationales behind this. But this idea that in a nation of over 300 million people that you could do one size fits all anywhere, I mean, isn't that just the greatest absurdity that someone living in rural Washington State would have the same educational needs and same experiences as someone living in New York City, that someone living in Little Rock, Arkansas would have the same concerns and the same ability to relate to the same educational materials as someone living in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois? Why would we expect that that's reasonable? And moreover, you have gifted students. You have students who are in need of remedial education. You have students from extremely wealthy backgrounds where they have, you know, every advantage you could ask for. You have students who are coming to school every day with food insecurity and with head pain because they can't afford dental work. And you have special education students, and they're all taking the same standardized test. Why, even if you gave them the same education, would you possibly expect A, equal outcomes, B, why would you tie funding to that? You're just going to penalize the disadvantaged kids even further. And C, why would you tie that to teacher evaluations?
But see, that's where, but I mean, I guess that's maybe where I'm coming from is the way you just laid that out, the predictability of failure is so absolute, and so absolutely clear, I should say, that you would only design a system like this purposely, because you couldn't put this together and actually think it's going to produce good results, because you just laid out how horrendously horrible standardization is when you're talking about the heterogeneity, or that would be a whole bunch of different types of kids with a whole bunch of different types of learning styles that live in a whole bunch of different geographic locations. And the fact that we're going to standardize them is just insanity. If that's so obvious to you and me, but yet we're not doing that, that's where I come from this This is what this is a nefarious plot to do away with public education.
It certainly looks like that's the direction the country is going right now, to me, with our current Secretary of Education. But I think the bigger thing that I think is apparent is how this disempowers teachers. How this really just prevents teachers from doing a good job at their job. It's a way to disincentivize, in a way, the hardest working individuals who appreciate the fruits of their labor being rewarded. It's really a way to disincentivize them from going into teaching. So it seems like this is, if I were to look at this as an outsider, as someone who never went into this field at all, I would say it really looks like a three-point plan. The first point is to drive the best people out of education. The second point is to produce a population that all has the same mediocre level of education. And the third point is going to be to say, well, if we can standardize all of this, then we don't even need teachers anymore, that we can just automate everything or make this a one-size-fits-all. So it's a way to devalue the teaching profession even further. I think, though, that almost all of us have had the experience of a remarkable teacher, of a teacher who's positively influenced or impacted our lives and our education, who's grown that curiosity within us. And as soon as you remember that teacher, as soon as you remember that experience you had, as soon as you remember that fire that got lit inside of you to explore that curiosity, to take on that challenge, to go after that ambitious thing that you didn't know whether you could tackle, but you knew you had to go for it. When you remember that spark that I think comes inside almost all of us at some point in our lives, you immediately know that all of this is a lie, that all of this is a ruse. And whatever the nefarious intent is, it's something that we have to fight against in this society.
Well, that's where we are right now. It's a massive fight, as you lay it out. I would remind everybody, go to Forbes.com and check out all of Ethan Siegel's writing, but this one particularly, How America is Breaking Public Education. And Ethan, we could go on and on, it sounds like, for the longest time, but I love the fact that a science teacher, now astrophysicist, the passion that you come across gives me hope that we can actually go out there and do better work, recruit better teachers. Is that what was motivated you behind writing this piece?
That was part of it, but the biggest part of it is if I could give any advice or any prescription for real success, I would say if you are a teacher out there, the best thing you can do to resist this direction that public education is being taken in is ignore the standardized tests. Don't teach to it. You'll get hit probably with a negative evaluation. Maybe you will, maybe you won't, but just be willing to take that hit because it's not reflective of reality. What is reflective of reality is something you won't see for 10, 15, 20 years until the students you're teaching now grow into adults and become the successful grown-ups you're working so hard to help them become. Keep doing that. Reach for your excellence and your greatness and aspire to have your students do the same. Don't let some false carrot that they're dangling in front of you keep you from doing the best job you can do and taking pride in what you are.
I got to put this right there. Ethan Siegel, you have truly busted pencils. Thanks awesome. For your time, man. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He is the author of Beware, The Road Builders, and Trumplandia from Garn Press. He is a professor of education at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. He is also the author of the popular blog Radical Eyes for Equity. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Paul Thomas.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
Hey, so your last piece in Radical Eyes for Equity, Segregation Surprise, How Public and Charter Schools Have Always Failed. So There's an issue in just right in the title, segregation surprise, question mark. We should not be surprised to find out that schools are segregated. Why?
Well, the piece was prompted because Andre Perry had a pretty pointed piece about the problem with segregation in charter schools. And as someone who's been writing about this for a pretty good while, I was trying to think today, I believe I probably started writing about the segregation problem in both public and charter schools about 2010 regularly, and I believe that's about when the research started coming out. And part of it is the consequences of turning New Orleans into all charter schools and not public schools anymore, or traditional public schools anymore. And the research coming out of New Orleans just kind of reinforced that the mechanism, whether it was traditional public schools or charter schools, didn't make that much difference, that issues of segregation are social, they're systemic.
Mm-hmm.
So schools are always going to sort of reflect the communities they serve, and communities are still horribly segregated. One thing that I point out to my education students is possibly the most segregated moment in U.S. In the United States weekly is churches. And it's very representative of how the society is segregated by both race and class. And
right.
Something like charter schools has just made it worse, because they've actually targeted monolithic populations of students.
Well, and so, you know, the Andre Perry piece that you're talking about was in the Hechinger Report, where it was charter school leaders are complicit with segregation and it's hurting their movement. And I took a look at the piece where he, you know, has a problem with the fact that the issue here is that for some reason some of the charter school apologists are saying, look, it's choice, and if for some reason more black and brown kids end up at the doors of these schools, that's not an issue of segregation. That's just what happens when you have free choice.
Right, and I think he did a nice job of pointing out, and I mentioned this, I believe it was 2011 piece that ended up in Truth Out, that it's sort of a reduced kind of false argument, because if you give people two horrible choices and they choose one of them, they did choose, but it's not like they chose, it's not like they had what they really wanted.
Right.
And so in black neighborhoods where there's a lot of crime, the people in the neighborhood may choose extreme police presence that is disproportionate to their presence in white neighborhoods. If that's their only two choices, high crime or a ever-present police force, they're going to choose an ever-present police force. But if they had real choice, or better yet, if they didn't have to choose, what if neighborhoods were just safe, and because people had good jobs and had all of the things that are common in gated, white, wealthy neighborhoods? And so the argument that a lot of us are making is, they shouldn't have to have choice, that these things should be provided without choice.
Right. Well, and so if we, right, it does kind of set this up. It's like, wait a minute, we're choosing, but really, as you point out there, it's you get to choose this death or this death. The end result is still, in this case, though, we still have segregated schools, whether or not it's the local community public school or whether it's the new charter school. The choice is going to not result in doing anything towards segregation. And so to use that as an excuse for saying, well, it's not segregation on purpose, it's segregation by choice.
Right.
You know, the other part, though, where I just like this, where you say to find it surprising that people still find it surprising that we're actually talking about segregation, and then you go forward and just lay out the research saying that, look, Made in America, segregation by design, segregation in charter schools, a reader, public school charters choice, more segregation by design. What is it about the fact that we, or maybe not you and me, but others or the society, just have such a tough time with looking at the research and saying, yeah, we have a segregation problem?
Well, I think it's ideological. We impose this belief in the free market onto everything, and it's sort of this silver bullet mentality that you see. People are pointing out that the new tax breaks that people are upset about. It's the idea that if you remove public institutions and you let the free market work, that things will be solved. And even though the evidence is overwhelming, that isn't true, that markets work better if you have robust public institutions. They actually work in conjunction. Mm. The absence of one or the other is not a healthy thing. So it's ideological. We just impose that. It's sort of like the mythology of the rugged individualism.
Mm-hmm.
We impose that on, I think somebody was praising Paul Ryan for his, rise to success, ignoring that he inherited $500,000 and then married into wealth and inherited more money.
Right.
So it's this imposing of ideology instead of looking at evidence.
Well, like you said, it's willful ignorance even there. And so using Paul Ryan to ignore the fact that where he is somehow the statement, and ignoring the fact that actually there was a bit of use of public services in part of his life that got him to where he was.
Right.
There's
many people like that that made their wealth on the backs of the public. And, and then act like I built this.
Right. Right. I built this. But so here's the hard question, though. If we know segregation is a problem, is forced integration the solution?
I think it's probably bigger than that. Are we going to do any kind of social programs that help the society itself integrate? And then sort of naturally, the institutions will be integrated. I think it has to be a combination. Same thing with education reform.
Mm-hmm.
Any education reform in isolation without social reform will not work. So I'd say it's a bigger social issue. Is why are we such a segregated society? And a lot of it has to do with race and class.
Yeah, and until we have that deeper discussion in the reality around race and class, I think you're right. I know I kind of set you up with that question. It's not really a question that could be answered because, as you point out, most of the time, in a lot of what you write, this idea that we can get away from the actual social systemic structures that are actually causing the inequities, causing segregation, causing racism, is what you say, willful ignorance is a word
right
that you use. So the blog is Radical Eyes for Equity. The piece, Segregation Surprise, How Public and Charter Schools Have Always Failed. Paul Thomas, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you a lot. I appreciate it.
Rivera Sun was a featured guest a few months back. You can hear that show now at bustedpencils.com. She's the author of Billionaire Buddha and The Dandelion Insurrection. Today, she tackles that famous Alfie Cohn question. Rivera, what are the schools our children deserve?
I believe our children deserve a school where they come first, where their unique intelligences and their unique ways of viewing and interacting with this amazing world that we live in are honored and respected, where their arcs of growth come first, and that we as communities, not just the teachers and not just the parents, learn to serve and show up in fostering a wide diversity of creative and talented individuals who also work within the beauty of the whole that we are. I believe that we should have great, well-funded public schools that function democratically and that even have a chance to put the children to have a seat at the table in that democratic functioning. I believe that we as taxpayers have the right and the responsibility to show up for all of our nation's youth that way, and that we also have the capacity to do so. So I think our children deserve the best from us, and that it is our duty as adults to figure out how to collectively show up to give that to them.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zen.
Pessimism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It reproduces itself by crippling our willingness to act.
My thanks to Ethan Siegel, Paul Thomas, Matt's mom, Rivera Sun, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slegger. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.